Nationalism creates strange ideological bedfellows. Charles de Gaulle saw history in uniquely nationalistic terms. He predicted the split between China and the Soviet Union in the 1960s, not from the perspective of an ideological rift within communism, but as the result of both countries' will to sovereignty and great power status. Similarly, he believed that the Warsaw Pact, the Eastern European bloc of communist countries, could be subverted by appealing to the historic interests of, say, Czechoslovakia as a nation beyond its mere subservience to Moscow. Let every nation have its communisms. Patriotic sentiments, positive or negative, can survive being shackled to an ideological construct that seeks to eliminate them. Regardless of what we think, no political system is ubiquitous with a nation state taken historically. When de Maistre declared that every country has the government it deserves, he indicates a deep historicist appreciation of politics, wherein systems are emanations of the context wherein a given people find themselves, a representation of a nation's virtues or misdeeds at any given time. They don't have to be literally communist to demonstrate this point. Indeed, this lesson should serve as a warning that no matter how reprehensible we view a political system from the outside, if placed under attack, patriotism finds a way to establish cohabitation, even symbiosis, between a nation and its government. I'm saying this with a view to understanding Iran's cohabitation with the Islamic Republic by analogy, in that I can present comparisons which on the surface would appear even more extreme and baffling to the cursory observer. In Hungary, for instance, a communist government was established under Bela Kun after World War I. Why would a Christian nation with a rigidly hierarchical social system tolerate that, even if briefly? Because Hungary was under attack, and its territory occupied by the Romanians and the Czechs. While Soviet Hungary disintegrated quickly, its Russian benefactor did not. And it is here that I'll focus on the character of a Russian general, Alexei Brusilov, to illustrate my broader point. Brusilov is the eponymous protagonist of the Brusilov Offensive, one of the largest, bloodiest, and successful campaigns of the First World War, a last hurrah for the Russian Imperial Army before the revolution. The Brusilovs were a military dynasty. Alexei's grandfather had fought Napoleon in the War of 1812. His father was a lieutenant general during the Crimean War, and as a cavalry officer, Alexei himself had fought for the Romanovs since Alexander II's war against the Ottoman Empire in the 1870s. At the beginning of World War I, Brusilov was given command of the Eighth Army, serving alongside Anton Denikin and Levi Kornilov. The latter would lead an unsuccessful coup against the revolutionary government of Alexander Kerensky. The former would serve as the de facto leader of the White Army during the Russian Civil War. Brusilov was ultimately given command of the frontier against Austria-Hungary, where he directed his famous offensive, leading to the near collapse of the Austrian army in the east and demonstrating greater levels of tactical innovation. Regardless, the situation in Russia deteriorated, and with riots in the capital of Petrograd, it was the army that took the decision to depose the Tsar, Nicholas II. During a state of war, regardless of what sympathies Brusilov possessed towards the revolutionaries, he believed in an undivided command. What the army plot under its ringleader Alexeyev represented was mutiny. Brusilov felt he had been effectively strong-armed into supporting the mutiny for the sake of presenting the Tsar with a fait accompli that a full consensus had been reached by the army to demand the Tsar's abdication. Despite Brusilov's reluctance, he was now Russia's most popular commander without being a member of the dynasty or of the high aristocracy, that which would only complicate his standing with the revolutionary government. So he was made chief of the army. While Russia's internal situation worsened, as the state effectively divided between the provisional government and the workers' councils or Soviets, Brusilov continued to insist on a single command and a united national effort to prosecute the war against Germany. As Kerensky attempted to introduce radical reforms to the army, Brusilov remained resolute in his commitment to harsh discipline and capital punishment, which extended to executing Bolshevik subversives, spreading anti-war propaganda, and radicalizing the soldiers. For this stance, he was removed and scapegoated for the government's military defeats. Kerensky was determined to die on the hill of no enemies to the left, while supporting the continuation of a war with a dissolving army. Ironically, Brusilov was replaced with the disloyal Kornilov, who had no qualms in directly opposing the government with military force. Brusilov placed himself at Russia's disposal, but was never called to service. He was a general without an army, as the broader Russian army collapsed along with the government. Despite being wounded during the October Revolution, he treated the rise of the Bolsheviks with indifference. He witnessed the Bolsheviks surrender to Germany, conceding much of the old imperial territory in the Baltic, Belarus, and Ukraine, which is independent of Russia today. As Imperial Germany collapsed, these independent nations competed with the Bolshevik Soviets and the Whites, a loose confederation of Tsarist officers, Cossacks, conservatives, and anti-Bolshevik liberals and socialists for the territory of the former Russian Empire. Brusilov's former colleagues, Denikin and Kornilov, joined the Whites, but Brusilov did not. Whether it was Kolchak's command in Siberia or Denikin's command in the south in Ukraine, Brusilov associated their actions as tantamount to foreign collaboration, as they were, to some degree, supported by the Western interventions into Russia. In particular, Brusilov heaped scorn on the Czechoslovak Legion, slowly making its way across the Trans-Siberian Railway due to its treatment of ordinary Russian citizens. To Brusilov, the actions of the white officers could only be comprehended as a consequence of their class, inaccurate given the radically heterogeneous composition of the white movement. Indeed, the actions of the whites were, for Brusilov, tantamount to offering up Russians as slaves to Anglo-French capitalism. The idea of foreign enslavement is a recurring theme in Brusilov's letters, an accusation he had previously levelled against the German Kaiser. Class criticism would potentially place Brusilov in synergy with the Bolsheviks' own arguments for the dictatorship of the proletarian class, but Brusilov didn't care that they were counter-revolutionaries. He cared that they were traitors, traitors to the Russian nation, irrespective of class affiliation. For this, Brusilov's legacy was subject to a condemnation of memory among the Tsarists and the white émigrés. The Soviets were equally suspicious of Brusilov's motives, spying on him and intercepting his letters. On his death, they concluded that Brusilov was never a convinced communist. Rather, he was a diehard and duplicitous counter-revolutionary. The extent of Brusilov's cohabitation with the communists reached its peak in May of 1920, during the Polish offensive towards Kiev. He wrote an appeal in Pravda, the communist newspaper, to all former officers wherever they might be, imploring them to join the Red Army, to forget their grievances against communism and join the patriotic struggle against Poland. By this time, Kolchak, Russia's titular supreme leader opposing Lenin, was dead. Denikin had been replaced by Wrangel in Crimea, and Poland was actively courting the Ukrainian secessionist movement from Russia. To Brusilov, the white movement was defeated, and Wrangel's remnant white army was the unwitting tool of Prometheism, the ideology of Poland's Pilsudski, an ideology committed to the dismemberment, if not the dissolution, of Russia itself. Nevertheless, Brusilov couched his arguments once again in terms of the aristocrat, in this case the Polish aristocrat, against Russia. Brusilov made a second, similar appeal to the army of Wrangel following the decisive Soviet defeat at the Battle of Warsaw. Brusilov would serve the Red Army in an administrative capacity for 4 more years. His state funeral was notable as the coming together of the Orthodox Christian Russia and that of the communist cause which he ultimately served. He was not a communist, but he died a general in the Red Army. Brusilov was the general who opposed the deposition of the Tsar, but ended up supporting Lenin. From an ideological standpoint, this would appear to be nonsense. Nationalism, however it manifested, whether as concern for the fate of the ordinary Russian, the Russian Church, or as chauvinism directed towards the Germans and later the Entente powers, is the key to understanding this figure. Indeed, a figure like Brusilov represents an ante-Putin, ante with an E, persons representing continuity between nominally incompatible systems, Tsarist Russia to the Soviet Union to the Russian Federation. The Brusilov of 1914 found communism as abhorrent as the Putin of 1986 found the idea of Soviet collapse. And yet, the context of the times, patriotism, the nation under attack, lets us understand these strange bedfellows.
Thank you.